bird note. Legends say that some 600 years ago, the Mexica people left their ancestral lands in Aztlán to build a powerful new empire. Their journey was guided by Huitzilopochtli, god of the sun and war, who told the Mexicas to look for the sign, an eagle perched on a cactus devouring a serpent. For years, they wandered what is now Mexico in search of that prophecy, until finally, they found the sacred bird on a tiny islet in the middle of Lake Texcoco. There, the Mexicas built a floating city right on the water. This was Tenochtitlan, capital of the Aztec Empire. And for several centuries and civilizations afterwards, it continued to grow and transform into the modern metropolis we now call Mexico City. Today, the golden eagle still perches on a prickly pear cactus in the center of the Mexican flag. Though the bird is immortalized in legend, real golden eagles now face threats like habitat loss, collisions with power lines and wind turbines, and poisoning from pesticides. By 2016, scientists estimated that fewer than 100 breeding pairs remained in Mexico. By protecting critical breeding grounds and supporting raptor research, conservationists are helping golden eagle populations bounce back across North and Central America, giving hope that this powerful symbol will soar above Mexico's mountains for generations to come. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.
Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
For decades, countries like Canada prospered under what we called the rules-based international order. We joined its institutions, we praised its principles, we benefited from its predictability. And because of that, we could pursue values-based foreign policies under its protection. We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false, that the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient, that trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition.
That was Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking at Davos in January. Is international climate action broken? What now? Political science professor Matthew Hoffman talks us through it. But we begin with the biggest underrated climate killer in America and in many other countries, wildfire smoke. Shocking new science with Dr. Chris Callahan. Plus scientist Sarah Burke, cities are getting hotter faster. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's go. Weather extremes are in the news, but one of the biggest climate-pumped killers is not. Even experts gravely underestimated tens of thousands of people dying annually, not from heat or storms, but wildfire smoke. This is not in some faraway land, but in the United States. Christopher Callahan leads and co-authors numerous studies. His latest work shows increasing deaths in America as climate change goes to 2 degrees C and beyond. This is a story of unmasking the wildfire threat spreading across continents in smoke. From the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Chris Callahan, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
You and I talked in December about mass heat mortality in Europe, and it was pretty shocking. Now tell us about deadly wildfire smoke in America. How serious is it already?
It's a very serious threat. A lot of people have seen the news of major wildfires in places like California and Canada a couple of years ago. I think one really important fact, though, is that most people's experience of wildfire in a warming climate is not going to be because of the direct fire that is in front of them, but because of exposure to the smoke from that fire. Wildfire smoke can carry hundreds or thousands of miles, and it can pollute the air that people are breathing from across a continent. So We know that this wildfire smoke is increasing because of climate change, increasing wildfires themselves. But until recently, we had a pretty weak understanding of the health impacts of that smoke. And so that's the work we've been doing most recently.
Chris, what are some of the ways fire smoke shortens people's lives? Is it just seniors who need to watch out?
I think that's a really good question that people are still trying to figure out. In short, no. Breathing in air pollution is dangerous for everyone. There is no safe level of it. Ultimately, this has been known for a really long time. There is very, very good science going back several decades about the health threats of wildfire smoke and broader air pollution for everyone, but of course, more so for people with asthma or other respiratory issues. But in general, everyone suffers when you breathe in dirty air. The research recently has shown, however, that wildfire smoke is becoming an increasingly important source of that dirty air in a way that it wasn't before.
Well, isn't that partly because we cleaned up some of the other pollution in cities?
That's absolutely correct. At least in the United States, the Clean Air Act has been an enormous success. Long-term concentrations of air pollution have been declining, or at least were declining for several decades. But in some places, including in the American West, in places like California and Oregon, that progress is beginning to be erased because of the increasingly common high concentrations of wildfire smoke.
Well, no doubt you've seen recent news on links between small particle pollution and Alzheimer's disease. I wonder, could increasing wildfire smoke lead to more cases of dementia?
It's possible. It seems like every week we see a new study about air pollution causing some other adverse health effect. And so I'm not an expert on the physiology of it, but my general sense is that if you can think of a health problem, there's probably a study showing that air pollution can worsen it.
Well, it's strange. I mean, North Americans grew up knowing that breathing car and factory smog was bad for us. Of course, Europeans know, everybody knows that. But nobody warned us about wildfire smoke. I mean, it seems sort of natural. It happens every summer. Is wildfire smoke as toxic as the industrial smog that we were trying to clean up?
So I think that's a really good question that we don't fully have the answer to. There is some evidence that wildfire smoke is worse than the kind of air pollution you get from a power plant or a car exhaust pipe. Part of the reason for this might be that the types of materials that are burned are different. So in a wildfire, especially one that burns human structures or buildings, you are igniting all of these synthetic materials like the vinyl or the plastic or the other stuff that we make our living arrangements out of. And those toxic materials might be more dangerous than other types. But again, I think this is something that we are currently still trying to figure out that we don't totally know the answer to.
Well, naturally, at the big institutes and the government level, several expert tools have been developed to assess the economic costs due to climate change. But as I understand from your study, these don't yet include wildfire smoke. Why not?
I think for a couple of reasons. One is that the health threats of climate change through wildfire smoke have only really emerged in the last decade or so. This is, I would say, a relatively recent area of understanding because of the very extreme wildfire years that we've experienced in places like California. But this has been only pretty recent. And more broadly, it's just a very difficult problem to address. It requires, to understand these costs, very good data on wildfire smoke, good data on health outcomes, and modeling frameworks that can put all of those things together. And so this is where the science is going now.
When wildfire smoke turned New England skies orange in the summer of 2025, much of that came not from the United States, but from the West and, well, from northern Canada. How did you handle that in your study?
So this is something that our study starts to look at, but I think there's more work that could be done on it. We look at smoke resulting from fires across all of North America, including fires in the United States and in Canada, where we have data on the burned area from wildfires and the emissions of particulate matter that are coming off those wildfires, so we can track how the smoke is moving across the United States, even if that smoke is coming from Canada. But it is absolutely true that some of the most extreme wildfire seasons we've seen in the last couple of years have been in Canada and not the United States. And so I think there's more research that has to be done to figure out how those two different places might generate similar or different impacts.
I took a look at the maps of dangerous smoke particles in the United States in your paper, and the Pacific Northwest looks periodically dangerous for health already. At 2 degrees, a lot of the West is going to be gasping for clean air when the fires are burning. And then 3 degrees C is just crazy, with only the Southeast and Florida keeping smoke-free air. So why did you conclude, quote, 70% of smoke-related mortality comes from states that are east of 95 degrees west longitude? Now, that would be states east of Iowa or Kansas. They're not really in the big forested fire zones. Why are the deaths showing up there?
That's mostly because that's where most people live. So in the United States, most of our population lives in parts of the eastern U.S. and along the East Coast. And so some of the most extreme wildfire smoke concentrations will happen in the western U.S., but when that smoke makes it over to the eastern U.S., it has a very big total health impact just because there are so many people living there to be exposed to the smoke.
You calculate the smoke dose for an average person in the United States for 2 or 3 or 4 degrees of warming. At 3 degrees, which still seems quite likely, Americans on average would get more than 5 times more dangerous smoke particles. That sounds like a public health emergency that could last for decades. Do we need to redesign public health and healthcare for growing wildfire smoke?
I think so, yes. I think this is a public health threat that we absolutely need to be considering. Unfortunately, right now, the government of the United States does not appear to consider climate change to be a public health emergency, but a lot of other governments and organizations are. In the context of wildfire smoke, I think this means we need to think about indoor air quality and air filtration, for example, as high priorities for lots of places like schools and workplaces.
Since the year 2000, scientists and governments try to assess the added cost per ton of carbon produced, and that might help figure out damages and health care and a variety of losses due to climate change. How does including wildfire smoke change that cost per ton of carbon estimate?
So within the United States, we have estimates of how much climate change costs the United States specifically. And when we integrated wildfire smoke into those calculations, we found that it increased the total cost of climate change by about 75%. So almost doubling of the total cost of climate change to the United States. I think it's fair to say that wildfire smoke may be the single most costly impact of climate change that we can currently quantify in the United States. Whether that's the case for other places around the world, I think remains to be seen. But it's certainly the case for the U.S.
How many more Americans will die prematurely, losing years of life due to wildfire smoke, if we get into a 3-degree hotter world?
So our numbers put this death toll at in the range of north of 50,000 deaths per year. So at 3 degrees Celsius, it might be in the range of 60 or 65,000 deaths per year, which is an enormous death toll. And this is consistent with other studies which have shown, even currently, tens of thousands of deaths per year due to wildfire smoke.
And we talked about heat deaths. How do you balance out how many people are dying because of the heat and how many people are dying because of the wildfire smoke, especially since they both may come at the same time?
Yeah, it's a good question. And this is something that we thought a little bit about. Our best estimate is that we have statistical techniques that can control for one and look at the other. So we can look, for example, at how mortality rates rise when there is greater wildfire smoke, then we can control for temperature. So we can say, assuming the temperature doesn't change, all else being equal, how does wildfire smoke affect mortality? And so we've done that so far in our work. But we are still trying to figure out, and lots of researchers are still trying to figure out, if there are interactions or joint impacts that we haven't fully considered. So when you experience a heat wave and wildfire smoke at the same time, is that somehow more dangerous than the sum of its parts? I think that's a really important scientific question that we don't fully know yet.
Your new paper says, quote, based on our estimates, reductions in wildfire smoke and related mortality are likely one of the most important benefits of greenhouse gas emission reductions in the United States, end quote. That sounds to me like a whole new picture, maybe for climate activism, like fighting and adapting or compensating for wildfire smoke damage. It's new.
I hope so. I hope this is something that gets taken up by people fighting for climate mitigation in the United States. This is a fight currently. This paper came out around the same time the federal government is attempting to rescind the legal authority for federal regulation of greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. And so I think many of the fights going forward about whether and how valuable it is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions do need to consider wildfire smoke very prominently in that conversation.
With a lot of climate threats, it's usually the poor who suffer and succumb first and most. What about wildfire smoke? Is it balanced like that?
So that is, again, something that we're currently trying to figure out. So far, it doesn't necessarily seem that the poor are significantly worse off. It looks like rich people and poor people alike suffer when the air is dirty, but it is certainly possible that folks with lower incomes maybe have less money to invest in air filtration or air filters. Maybe homes are less well insulated or ventilated, and things like that. So I think that's an important thing for us to consider moving forward.
Well, greenhouse gas regulation in the United States is breaking down. Individually, we could make our own communities more fire resistant. We could use masks outside and HEPA filters inside. Can individual action handle this increasing climate-driven risk?
I don't think it can handle it entirely on its own, but I do think it's worth thinking about. Absolutely, if you are in a place that suffers from wildfire smoke regularly, you absolutely should be wearing a mask when you go outside, and you absolutely should, if you can, invest in indoor air filtration. And ideally, we would be doing that in our businesses and our commercial areas and public spaces as well. You can think about this like the way we think about cooling centers during heat waves, where places like libraries or other public areas will make themselves cooling centers because they have air conditioning. We also need to be thinking about clean air areas, right? Places where there is safe, clean air to breathe that you can get out of the smoke for a little while. But ultimately, all of those things are insufficient to fully mitigate the threat unless we also reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Recently, as published in The Guardian, the European Scientific Advisory Board on Climate Change said adapting to 3 degrees C of warming is, quote, doable for Europe. And you posted a quick reminder that 3 degrees C of warming would set Europe up for heat domes that kill 30,000 people in a single week. And in fact, you study that in a February 2025 paper called Present and Future Limits to Climate Change Adaptation. What do you think, Chris? Can Europe really adapt to a world that is 3 degrees hotter than pre-industrial?
I'm skeptical. I think we won't know until it happens, if it does happen, although my fingers are crossed that it doesn't. I think it is important to not be overly optimistic about the potential for adaptation. It is certainly possible that some people will adapt. Definitely some people will have air conditioning. Some people will have indoor air filtration, but many people won't. And so it's important to be thinking about all of the people who will be left by the wayside and left to suffer if we decide that we are just going to withstand the impacts of global warming instead of actually preventing them.
Looking at some of your earlier work, we hear predictions these days that the hotter El Nino condition could develop even later this year. In 2023, you looked into the persistent effect of El Nino on global economic growth, and that was before the big one of 2023 and the residual heat that came in 2024, the hottest year so far. You found extreme El Nino cost the global economy trillions of dollars in losses, but I'm wondering, is that a lasting impact, or does the economy just rebound with the cooler La Nina periods?
We found that El Nino has these longer-term persistent impacts on the economy. So after an El Nino event, the economies of many tropical countries experience multiple year-long reductions in economic growth due to the sort of legacy effects of the increasing floods, heat, drought, wildfires, and so on that are pretty consistently associated with El Nino conditions. This effect is mostly concentrated in the tropics, so it's not necessarily the case for the U.S. and Europe or Canada, but for many countries around the world, El Nino events do leave really significant economic scars.
Have you found a direct relationship between El Nino events and even worse smoke from wildfires?
That I'm not sure about. I haven't looked at that. There is evidence that in the 1997-1998 El Nino event, there were major wildfires across much of Indonesia, which caused enormous wildfire smoke plumes to spread across much of Asia. And so there is at least anecdotal evidence that could be a really significant hazard.
If massive wildfires continue to burn in the United States, in Canada, and across Russia, won't that create a kind of burned-out state? I mean, with less fuel left, could wildfires and deadly smoke decline as the century progresses?
So this is, again, a really active area of research and something we're trying to figure out. The short answer is yes, to some degree. When you burn an area, it means you have less vegetation available to burn the next time. And so we did find some sort of protective benefit, actually, of wildfire for future fire. And this is actually why we often want to do prescribed burning or cultural burning in lots of places, especially by indigenous nations who have a lot of knowledge of the ways that fire can actually be a beneficial process on a landscape, right? Fire is natural. It's been a part of our landscape forever. And so having some level of beneficial fire is really important for landscapes to be healthy. Ultimately, though, I think the kind of mega fires that we've seen in places like the U.S. and Russia and Canada aren't really the kind of beneficial fires that we want to be encouraging.
Yeah, we don't want to keep going just till we reach the blacked out planet, because that's not going to be good. Now, suppose humans somehow do take action and manage to hold warming to 2 degrees C over pre-industrial. That would probably cost a lot of money and it would take commitment by all of us. Would it be worth it? Instead of keeping the economy going, even though 3 degrees is going to be the result, what difference can we make?
I think it's absolutely worth it. And I think the evidence has become quite clear that the health and economic harms of going from 2 degrees Celsius to 3 degrees Celsius are not worth the benefits to production from fossil fuel emissions, right? It is cheaper to mitigate global warming than it is to let global warming continue. And that's because all of the health and economic harms are so severe. And so, and even the harms that we've counted up, when there are many harms that we haven't yet counted up and don't yet know about. And so I think even if you're thinking just from an economic perspective, there is a business case for limiting global warming.
Since your time at Stanford and MIT, you've published a lot of key papers, many of them about relationships between the economy and climate change. What are you working on next?
I'm still thinking a lot about climate change and health, and so the health impacts of rising temperatures are something I'm really interested in. In particular, I want to understand the ways that high temperatures might disrupt healthcare systems. So if many people have to go to the emergency department during a heat wave, what does that do to patients who need unrelated care and who might need to use the hospital for other reasons? Does their care get disrupted when there is a large influx of patients during a heat wave? Those kinds of healthcare costs are something I think we need to be really thinking about.
From the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, we've been speaking with Dr. Christopher Callahan. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Deadly heat waves are a new fact of life in a warming world, and cities are even hotter than the surrounding countryside. We did not know that urban heat island effect becomes more extreme as the planet moves to 2 degrees and hotter. It is another unpleasant surprise. Here to untangle all that is Dr. Sarah Burke. After a time in finance, Sarah began a serious study of the urban heat island effect in the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Now she's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of North Carolina Data-Driven Lab. Sarah is lead author of the new PNAS paper, Amplified Warming in Tropical and Subtropical Cities Under 2 Degrees C Climate Change. From Chapel Hill, Sarah Burke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
The fact that cities get hotter than the surrounding countryside, that's been known since the British climatologist Gordon Manley first described it in 1958. Now we realize even that will change as the climate warms up?
Yeah, so actually this, the urban heat island effect, it was the first time that humans realized that they were impacting the local climate. So it's something that we've known about for a long time, but it's kind of driven by different climates. So if you're in an arid climate versus a really humid climate, the magnitude of the heat island might be different. So it kind of follows that if this is something which is influenced by climate, if the climate is changing, then the magnitude of this heat island could also change in the future.
Well, I don't know. I thought they could just sort of move in lockstep so that if it's 1 degree warmer, let's say, in the whole part of the Carolinas, then the cities will just be 1 degree hotter. But it doesn't work like that.
The urban heat island is essentially kind of a relative effect. So it's a product of both the urban environment and also the rural environment. So something that we're seeing in the future is actually that climate changes can have an impact on the rural surroundings of a city. So if we're looking at the impact of 2 degrees warming on a rural area, that might lead to vegetation changes. So if there's less or more vegetation in an area, that can amplify the difference between the urban and rural areas. So vegetation versus concrete have very different interactions with the climate. So if one of those areas is changing, then the temperature in that area will change in a different way.
Well, yes, why are cities hotter? Is it just the mass of concrete and asphalt, or is there more to it? What are the various mechanisms that make us hotter in the cities?
There's a few different reasons for it. So exactly what you're saying, there's differences in thermal properties. So concrete can heat up very quickly and then dissipate that heat very quickly to the surrounding air, whereas grass and kind of like surfaces with a lot of water retention, it can take them a really long time to heat up. So an example of that would be the ocean. So it can store a lot of heat without its temperature increasing as much. But in cities, concrete heats up really quickly, and then at the night time that heat just radiates out and warms the air. Also, this might be getting a bit too technical, but an important aspect is also the way the heat is transferred. So in rural areas, you typically have a lot of water retention, so a lot of moisture. And when solar radiation heats up an area, the change of state from a liquid to a gas actually takes in a lot of energy without increasing the temperature of that area. So in a rural area, you have a lot of that type of heating, which is called latent heating. The solar radiation shining on that area will not actually increase the temperature as much because it's evaporating water. But in a city, there's very little water retention. So all of that heat from the sun is going into actually heating up the temperature of city surfaces. And then you also have buildings, so those can limit ventilation because wind is not able to kind of dissipate the heat. And you have internal heat sources as well. So buildings giving a lot of heat with the HVAC systems and then vehicles as well. They're also letting a lot of heat out. So there's many kind of different factors which lead to urban areas being warmer than their rural surroundings.
Well, just to nail this down, let's take a case like Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a subtropical city with 500,000 people, I think. And in 2021, a community group measured the difference between downtown Raleigh and the countryside. And they found an amazing 9 degrees Fahrenheit or 5 degrees C extra heat in town. So if the global mean average goes 1 degree, say, hotter than it is right now, how would that city-to-country difference change?
Something that we were looking at in the paper was changes in the land surface temperature rather than air temperature. But if the rural land surface temperature of an area was to increase by 1 degree Celsius, something that we saw in many cities was the additional warming in the city was from 0.5 degree to 1 degree Celsius warmer. So the total change in the urban area would actually be 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warmer, whereas the rural area would just increase by a single degree. And that's kind of very city or area specific, so it would kind of depend on the type of climate that the city was located in. So in particular, we saw that the cities in monsoon regions, these are the cities where the urban warming is a lot faster than the warming in the surrounding area.
Before your new study, we did have studies of the urban heat effect in megacities like Tokyo or New York. Why did mid-sized cities get left out, and does that really matter?
Many studies focus on those megacities because they are important. There are a lot of people who live in those areas, and you would expect them to have a very